Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young. On today's show, we continue the conversation we started last week about the power of stories. We're looking at food insecurity and how the narratives surrounding poverty can distort the realities of people's lives. We'll look at the role isolation plays in food insecurity and what it can mean for food providers to move from a charity model to a model of social justice. And Chef Daniel Orr makes a familiar condiment from a scraggly root. That's all just ahead on Earth Eats. Alex Chambers has a couple of news items for us. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Kate. Farm workers are committing suicide at a rate twice that of veterans, according to a study by the CDC. And it's no wonder. Since 2013, net farm income for U.S. farmers has declined 50%. Median farm income for 2017 is projected to be negative $1,300. But few were talking about it until now. An article in The Guardian, published in December, details America's history of farmers struggling with mental health. Writer Debbie Weingarten and photographer Audra Mulkern, two well-known ag documentarians and activists, detailed the mental health struggles of American farmers past and present. The article prompted the Washington State Legislature to propose House Bill 2671, which aims to establish a pilot program for behavioral health and suicide prevention for employees of the agriculture industry. The bill was authored by J.T. Wilcox, a fourth-generation farmer and a Washington state representative. It calls for the State Department of Health to develop resources focused on behavioral health for workers and their families. Among the stresses it cites are job-related isolation, the heightened potential for losing money, and barriers to accessing mental health services. The weather might be another stress. The recent cold across the Midwest has slowed down river barges carrying grain to shipment ports. Harvest Public Media's Christopher Husted reports some experts say it puts the U.S. market at risk.
Barge traffic destined for the Gulf of Mexico is crawling along the Mississippi, Ohio, and Illinois rivers due to heavy ice buildups. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says that in the first 2 weeks of 2018, barges have carried 60% less grain compared to last year. That troubles Mike Steenhook, the executive director of the Soy Transportation Coalition, who says the cold weather is encumbering farmers' ability to meet export demand.
And for soybeans, it's particularly acute because 80% of our exports occur between the months of September and February. So this is a real key time, an opportune time for us to meet that international demand.
Steenhook says the fear is if not enough grain makes it to port, countries like China will turn to Argentina and Brazil for grain. Christopher Husted, Harvest Public Media.
With the Farm Bill just around the corner, Agriculture Secretary Sonny Perdue unveiled last week what he wants to see in the bill. He laid out what he called a roadmap, culled from his visits to rural America since taking office last spring. His priorities lack hard details, but there are a few key themes for Perdue. One is continuing crop insurance and other safety net programs for farmers. Another priority of Perdue's is having a cutting-edge scientific research agenda. Ag industry groups and public universities already asked for twice as much money for research in the coming farm bill. The House Agriculture Committee leader has said he'd like the full chamber to vote by March. But Kansas Republican Pat Roberts, who heads the Senate Ag Committee, told Harvest Public Media its proposal won't even be ready for a hearing until March. And that wraps up our news.
Thank you, Alex Chambers.
No problem, Kate. And thanks to Harvest Public Media and Taylor Killow for those reports.
There's not much that's seasonal in the dead of winter here in the Midwestern United States. But Chef Daniel Orr may have found something. Let's head to the kitchen and let him tell us all about it.
We are doing something really great today that you can do all winter long. Anytime that the ground is thawed enough to put a spade in it, you can harvest horseradish. I got some roots over here that I harvested yesterday, and you can see them. They're kind of gnarly and dirty, and they're really crazy. And you want to really make sure that you get all the dirt off the horseradish. And then you take a vegetable peeler, and then you peel them. And you can see that they're nice and white. I'm going to chop them up. Kind of the smaller you chop them, the quicker it is going to be to grind it. And you can use a blender for this, or a food grinder, an old-fashioned hand-cranked food mill, or not food mill, but a food grinder, a sausage grinder. But the best thing is a food processor. And we're just going to take this, it's about 2 cups of roots, and to that we're going to add just a couple ingredients. We're going to add a tablespoon of white vinegar and a pinch of salt and just a little bit of white sugar. I like to put a little white sugar, or you could use agave, you could use honey. And what that does is can be a little bit of bitterness. I mean, I really love that horseradish aroma and flavor, but sometimes there also can be a little bit of bitterness. And so that little bit of salt or a little bit of sugar really kind of stops that. Now, when you're grinding horseradish, the vinegar is going to hold the flavor. So if you were just to grind it, some people grind it with a little bit of water, the flavor is going to dissipate and actually the aroma is going to leave the horseradish. So the vinegar actually chemically keeps that really aggressive, fiery horseradish flavor in the mixture you're making. Get that going or grind it up nice and fine. And there's lots of ways to use horseradish. One of the ways the Brits use it is they make their horseradish cream, and they serve that a lot with their Sunday roast beef, and Yorkshire pudding, that kind of thing. So you just mix that with some sour cream. A lot of Americans love cocktail sauce, so you could either make your own ketchup or buy ketchup and add this fresh grated horseradish to that. I also like to put it in vinaigrettes. I like to have it with beets. Beets and horseradish are great. And you can actually even make a little version of this. You do the same recipe, but you add about a half of a raw beet. And you grind that up, and you're going to have a nice purple horseradish. And then you can keep a jar of the white and keep a jar of the purple horseradish and serve those. Those are also great, again, served with cold cuts. It's great with a cold chicken sandwich. If you do like things like pâtés and terrines, it's a nice accompaniment for those. And, of course, on hot dogs and bratwursts. So get out there, grow some horseradish. It's super easy to grow. And, basically you can't kill it. Once it's decided to live with you, you can't get it out of your house. So you'll pull it up, you'll dig it up, and there'll always be one little piece left in there, and the whole plant will come back. So enjoy horseradish. Make it your friend.
That is so strong. Must be because it's so fresh. You just dug it up.
Yeah, just dug up yesterday. I'm going to put that in a ball jar, keep it in the fridge, and it will last probably about up to a month.
And instructions for making your own prepared horseradish can be found, as always, on our website at eartheats.org. Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side corner of Pete Ellis and Longview, brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Last week on Earth Eats, we dove into a conversation about the power of stories. We spoke with Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, a community food resource center in Bloomington, Indiana. We talked about some of the narratives surrounding food insecurity and how those stories and the way we talk about hunger has an impact on how we approach solutions. Our conversation about the power of stories continues today and also moves into a discussion about the role of isolation in food insecurity. We'll also take a look at what it means to move from a charity model to a social justice model.
I am Amanda Nicky, the president and CEO of Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
And I'm Stephanie Solomon, the director of education and outreach at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard.
One of the narratives we discuss surrounding food assistance and poverty generally is the bootstrap story. The one that says the American dream is all about equal opportunity. We often hear tales in public speeches, for example, of the courageous individual beating the odds. They overcame so many obstacles. They, you know, came from extreme poverty or they came from a horrible household and they were able to pull themselves up and be successful.
We call those the unicorn stories.
Yeah, I mean, there's always examples of someone that there's a there, you know, that are held up.
Right. And I think, I mean, those are the compelling stories, right? Those are the stories that encourage people to give or encourage people to be engaged in an organization or, you know, those are the stories that we write in the appeal letters that we send out at the end of the year. But it those aren't it's not the whole story. It's not the story of everyone who comes through the doors at Mother Hubbard's Cupboard. Not every patron has a hopeful story. Not every patron has a story that's going to end well.
Those stories, though they may be true, they're also still perpetuating that narrative that if this person can, then anyone can.
And it makes it seem like it's personal failings, or poor choices or lack of ambition, those kinds of things that make it easier to write off someone who didn't succeed in the way that we thought they should. And we know that it's all complex. It's not black and white. It's not this person made this decision on this day and now they are homeless because of that one decision. It's a lifetime of circumstances and decisions, but also lack of choices that lead people to find themselves kind of in this cycle of poverty.
I think this discussion of the bootstrap narrative really feeds well into the national discussions that we're having right now about gender and racial inequity and what it would look like to have true diversity and inclusion in our society.
Okay, I'd like to pause here for a moment for a brief explanation of the word equity. What is the difference between equality and equity? Sometimes they're used interchangeably, but they are not the same. My favorite visual for this includes three frames. In the first one, we see three kids trying to look over a fence at a baseball game. They are of varying sizes, and none of them can see over the fence. In the second frame, they're each standing on a crate, and the crates are all the same size. Only the tallest kid can see over the fence. That's equality. Each child got the same assistance, but since they were starting from different places, only the tallest one could reach the goal of seeing over the fence. In the third frame, the tall kid stands on one crate, the middle kid stands on two crates, and the littlest one stands on three crates. They can now all see over the fence. That's equity. Recognizing that we don't all start out at the same place, so some need more assistance than others to reach a level playing field. Okay, back to Stephanie Solomon.
If we're working from the assumption that we are an equitable society, then the burden falls on the individual when they can't, for example, afford food. But if we're working from the understanding that the story is much more complex than that, then we can see that there are many opportunities that are being lost because of systemic issues that we have. And again, if we take that holistic look at those issues, we can really reframe and find some opportunities for true food security in our communities, but also in our larger culture.
So one of the things that I have seen come up in your work is the idea of moving from a charity model to a social justice model. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that means to you to move from a charity model. What's wrong with charity, and shouldn't we all be charitable?
So I think this goes back to that idea of, like, kind acts in themselves are good, right? The charity is good. We can say that right up front. But if you want to see something change, if you want there to be an improvement, if you want the situation that for that individual requires a charitable act to improve, then you have to bring in this idea of social justice. You have to think about, does this person have the opportunities or the support that they need in order to be successful in what it is they're trying to be successful in? If it's just being able to make ends meet or take care of their family or go to school or further their education or whatever, it's important to look at what are the structures that are in place that are keeping them from doing that? What are the obstacles that are in their way? And charity alone isn't going to solve that problem. It might solve that problem for that one person, but it's not going to solve the problem for the next person.
Often there's a patronizing air behind charity. It's very much in the narrative of us and them. We are the givers and they are the receivers. And like Amanda said, charity is not a bad thing. Giving and receiving is natural and necessary. But we want to be the kind of organization where we are all one. Those of us that are putting the food on the shelves and those of us receiving the food from the shelves, all of us together are working for a more just community. And that's how I see a true transition from a charity to a justice model. It's breaking down those walls and saying, how can we all work together for the kind of community that we all want to work in, instead of us telling folks, this is what you need and this is what your community should look like.
So I saw on the wall at Mother Hubbard's cupboard, food is a basic human right. What do you mean by that?
We mean by that just what it sounds like, that everybody deserves access to the food that they need. So just like water, clean water, is a basic human right, food is also a human right. We would not be able to live and sustain our bodies without food.
I think it's also important to think about it in terms of access to food is a basic human right. Because when the focus is on access, what that means is that we have to do something. If we're talking about creating access to food for everyone, that everyone should have equal access, it requires that we focus on structures and we assess what are the obstacles. If we're just talking about food as a basic human right, it takes the responsibility away from the larger community to do something about that.
Or to do something other than hand someone some food.
Exactly. It means that we have a social structure, an economic structure that supports that everyone can take care of themselves.
So the difference there is taking care of themselves rather than having to rely on a charity or on a social service.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That makes me think about how in our mission we talk about dignity and self-sufficiency. And if you take that kind of at a surface level and talk about self-sufficiency as an insular thing, as an individual or a family building their own self-sufficiency, that's kind of missing the larger point, which is that self-sufficiency is achieved when we build networks in our community. Self-sufficiency is possible when we have a village to rely on. It's not just about providing food and education around cooking and gardening. It's also about breaking the social isolation of those experiencing poverty and hunger and building a village of networks for folks to rely on each other.
And that really does increase your food security. The more resources you have, the more people that you know, the more connections that you have. I mean, when you think about something just as simple as dinner tonight, I ran out of groceries. It's the end of the month. I don't have a paycheck. But if you invite me over to your house or if I'm your neighbor and I can like stop in, that's already increasing my food security, just having that connection. So I could see where experiencing poverty and also being isolated in your community, not having those connections, could really, in a tangible way, affect your access to food and other resources.
Yeah, I mean, I think back on when I was a kid, and my mother was very close to all of our neighbors. And if we needed something, we knew that we could go to a neighbor and ask. And as a kid, I didn't think about the fact that maybe the reason we were asking the neighbor was because we couldn't afford it ourselves. I just knew that if we needed something, we could ask the people that lived around us, the people that we were close to. And I think that a lot of people are missing that, especially in low-income communities. But something that came out of some research that a doctoral student did for us a few years ago, they surveyed people in a low-income community and found that those people who knew their neighbors and felt connected to their neighbors reported feeling less food insecurity. They felt like they could rely on neighbors for support when they needed it. And it's an obvious thing that we probably know, but I think it's great that there's some research to back that up, especially in our own community.
I asked Nikki and Solomon about the difficulties in moving towards a social justice model while still serving as a food provider in the community. I asked about some of the risks and complications involved in bringing forward the problems inherent in providing direct food aid. We talked about the risk of alienating some of the supporters of the organization and about how, at least in this moment, it's not an either-or situation.
It would be naive for us to think that we could shut the pantry down tomorrow, and not only naive, it would be cruel. For better or for worse, we have this position in the community and we are providing groceries for, you know, thousands of people a week. We can't step away from that, but it doesn't mean that we can't focus on other things and try to build power in other ways and try to listen to people who aren't often being listened to, or to kind of raise up those stories of patrons that aren't being heard otherwise. We can do both.
As somebody who worked at the food bank and then moved to Mother Hubbard's in my current role, there's a very strong narrative in the food bank about the work that's being done. And just like any other story, it has its truths, but it has its holes, too. And so in some ways...
What is that narrative?
Well, the narrative is the one that we talked about earlier, which is that people need to eat food today. People need food on their plates today. And so we are doing the good work of making sure that everybody has the food that they need. And so if that's our narrative, that's what our role is, and that anything else that we do is mission creep, then it's going to be pretty uncomfortable to sit down and have people say, let's look at the ways that this system reinforces systems of oppression. So it's inevitably going to be uncomfortable to change that narrative. But I think there's a lot of people that are ready to do the work.
So by mission creep, you just mean, you know, where you're getting off, you know, your mission is to feed people. Don't expand it beyond that.
I read about mission creep in Andy Fisher's book, Big Hunger, where he discusses the challenges that food banks and other emergency food providers have in taking on issues outside of hunger-related policies. So, for example, he talks about that they might have an advocacy wing as a part of a food bank, but the advocacy wing is pretty constrained in terms of talking about issues like SNAP or food stamps and child nutrition reauthorization. Whereas if the city that the food bank is in has a living wages campaign, it's often seen by the food bank to be mission creep to get involved, even though living wages would do a lot for people experiencing hunger and needing their services. In the world of anti-hunger, if your mission is to get food on people's plates, it can feel like mission creep if you're looking at roots of hunger like poverty and injustice. So we have to look outside of the vacuum of hunger for it to even make sense to be looking at these bigger issues.
I've been speaking with Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon from Mother Hubbard's Cupboard, or The Hub, in Bloomington, Indiana. The Hub is a community food resource center offering food pantry services, education around growing and cooking food, and an advocacy program focused on equity and social justice. You've just heard part two of our conversation. You can find the first installment at eartheats.org. We would love to hear your thoughts on the issues we addressed here. You can reach us by email, eartheats@gmail.com, or continue the conversation on Twitter or Facebook. You'll find us at Earth Eats. You can subscribe to Earth Eats wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what we're doing, leave a rating or a review. It helps other listeners find us. Thank you. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. NeedMoreRoasters.com. A big shout out to everyone who makes Earth Eats possible. And that includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killo, Daniel Orr, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Amanda Nicky and Stephanie Solomon. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I thank you for joining us today. We'll see you next week on Earth Eats.